You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org. Hello, this is Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. My name's Deep Tran. I'm the associate editor of American Theater, and I'm sitting here with
I'm Erin Salvi. I'm the Publications Associate for TCG Books.
And our guest from San Francisco.
I'm Lily Janik, and I'm the theater critic for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yes, it is an all-ladies edition of Off Script. The reason being, first we're going to talk about the controversy around Stephen Adley Gergis and a production of one of his plays that had some unlicensed script changes and the conversations around that. And then we have an interview that Rob did with documentary theater artists Anushka Paris Carter and Andy Paris about their new show Uncommon Sense from Tectonic Theater Project. It's playing in New York. And then we'll come back with recommendations. First of all, I feel like this is the elephant in the room, and we should talk about it in some fashion. Charlottesville. Last week, in reaction to the protest and the counter-protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, Teresa Eyring, of the Executive Director of Theater Communications Group, in her weekly briefing to the TCG individual members, it opened with Charlottesville, and I wanted to read a snippet from that, just so that we acknowledge that this has happened and acknowledge that as theater people and people who love theater, that there are things that we can also do. And so I just want to read a snippet of it. Dear colleague, this week has our hearts in Charlottesville and our minds on the ever-present need to challenge and dismantle racism in our society. We are in grief over an act of domestic terrorism amid another white supremacist rally, and dismayed by the way in which our administration continues to minimize the seriousness of these events, tacitly glorifying crimes that are born out of hatred and bigotry. While forces of violence and discrimination are hardly new in the U.S., in recent months they seem newly emboldened. Theater is a place for empathy, understanding, and human connection. How can we as a field step up our work against violence and oppression in our communities and our nation? I wasn't sure if either of you ladies had any thoughts on how you've been reacting and any self-care things, any things to promote empathy. Do we have any thoughts on that?
I guess for me as a journalist at a big paper like The Chronicle, I'm actually prohibited from attending protests unless I'm actually, you know, covering them. That's just part of journalism ethics. And so that for me just makes the way I write my reviews, which is, I guess, the way I can register some kind of protest or register some kind of grief or anger, it's all the more incumbent upon me to bring the broader social context into my articles. Why is this show important? Why is its success or failure in its goal important?
And then also, like, which artists we choose to prioritize and
right on
cover and how we cover them. That's all.
Absolutely.
Very important.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I think, like you said, it has been difficult because it has been so, I think what I've been saying to a lot of people is that it feels unbelievable but not surprising to me, if you know what I mean. But it's still horrific to see where we are right now. And just as an individual, I've been trying to read as much as I can, have as many conversations with people as I can to try to figure out best ways, both short-term and long-term, that we can combat this. And it's difficult. I don't know that there is an absolutely clear way of doing that, but I've been, you know, really glad to see the protest in Boston that just happened. See people coming out to really show that this is not something that the majority of our country supports. I think it's something that I'm going to have to keep working on and figuring out the best ways that I can contribute to this.
What I've loved is seeing just those statements of solidarity coming from, you know, theaters and theater artists in these places where there are protests and also where there are these Confederate monuments. And seeing that, yes, we are all different and we have all these big concerns right now in the state of the field, how you uphold a theater, how you be a proper journalist in a time like this. But I think like there's been like this open-heartedness within the reactions I'm seeing on Facebook and Twitter about this has gutted a lot of people and it's gutted a lot of us. And how do we have an open-hearted, uncomfortable conversation about these issues, because we cannot pretend that they don't exist anymore when they are literally marching in our streets with Nazi flags. So, in the spirit of conversation and podcasting, Stephen Adley Gerges. Lily, you wrote a wonderful article in the San Francisco Chronicle about this controversy. Can you sum it up for us?
Sure. So, there's this theater in Union Square called the Shelton Theater. It's been around for almost 25 years. Basement theater, two venues. And they do a lot of classics. A guy named Matt Shelton runs it, and he and his director Richard, I might be mispronouncing his last name, so forgive me here, but Richard Ciccarone. So as Matt later told me in an interview, kind of as this whole thing was still unfolding, they freely adapted the script. So they cut a cast of, you know, I think the script lists well over 20 characters, but it can be produced with fewer than that. But they cut it down to 9. They cut a show that runs well over 2 hours, almost 3 hours in some cases, down to 80 minutes. And they also moved a monologue from one place to another. Gerges found out through his licensing house, which is Dramatist Play Service, and initially he was going to let the show continue. He has a long-standing kind of championing of actors, and he didn't want to deprive them of work. But then, well, he was going to let the show continue as long as the company printed this insert in their programs for the rest of the run. And that insert read, "The play you are seeing tonight has been improperly and extensively cut and edited. These edits and cuts were made without permission, against the wishes of the playwright, and in violation of federal copyright law." So all the folks who were seeing pretty much just the last few performances of the show, because this all happened late in the show's run, they were going to see that. And one of them, a local playwright, a guy who I know, his name's Aaron Hwan, he went to the show and he saw that warning, you know, printed in the program. And he took pictures of that and also of the director's note, which kind of talked about how a script is open to interpretation. That's not a direct quote, but a script is a living document, basically. So he posted that to a Facebook group called the Official Playwrights of Facebook, and that's how it got back to the playwright. And what he took issue with was kind of the way his warning, or what he wanted to be inserted, that text was framed with a great big red warning label kind of underlaying the text, almost like a photo watermark. And he thought that made it look cheesy, like it's some kind of taboo. He just really didn't like the way that was framed. And then in contacting the theater about this, they were initially kind of slow to respond. So it was only at that point, you know, really after being kind of generous and understanding, that he revoked the show's rights, that he issued them a cease and desist order. And at that point, the show's last four performances were canceled. So he would have been within his rights completely to revoke it from the beginning, but it was kind of a straw broke the camel's back situation. So that's what unfolded.
So, copyright. Aaron, we have you here so that you can talk about why a play is not a living document.
Yes, that is correct. So, basically, any work that is copyrighted, such as this play is, means that the playwright has absolute control over how people can use that work. And some playwrights, if you ask permission, might actually allow you to make cuts to their work. It really depends. Some say, no, this is absolutely fixed. You may not change a single word. You cannot drop a the. You cannot do anything like that. That's absolutely well within their rights. It belongs to them. And that is always stated in any licensing agreement that any theater would make with a publishing house. And in this case, like you mentioned earlier, that's Dramatis Play Service. It absolutely would have been in the agreement made. But even if it hadn't been, it's still protected under copyright law, and you need to request permission anytime you want to make any changes. And, you know, I think Gerges was pretty generous here in the beginning because, like you mentioned, he could have just shut it down, but he, you know, had some. This is a small theater. They, I don't think, have a huge budget, and he really is a champion for actors and theater artists. But you cannot make changes to anything under copyright law without permission. And the biggest what got this theater into such trouble is that they did not ask permission, and in fact, the director knew that he was violating copyright when he did that. He wasn't ignorant of that law. So.
I found the quote, by the way, from his director's note in the program. Mm-hmm. So, as a director, an actor, a designer, a producer, a stage manager, a board operator, and an audience member, we are all part of taking the work of one artist and reinterpreting it into our own separate experiences. This play may not be what the author intended in his original vision, but as a work of art, I believe it is our duty to interpret and not simply repeat, to participate, not just transmit, and by doing so, become a collaborator in the work.
Right. Yeah, and that's an interesting take on that. And of course, theater is unique plays are unique in terms of written creative work in that in order for them to be presented as they should be, they are a collaborative process between all of the artists, the director, the lighting designer, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, there are artistic liberties that you can take often with lighting, with set design, with costumes, but you do not have the right to play around with the language of the play, to make cuts, to move a monologue from one place to another. And again, it's not a perfect analogy, but if you imagine someone taking a famous novel, cutting giant sections of it, moving other sections around, like if it was To Kill a Mockingbird or something, and then teaching that to a classroom of students, that wouldn't be okay. And that is akin to what happened here. The playwright has crafted something very specifically for a reason, and their vision is being scrambled whenever you do something like that. And even if you think it might work better in a different way, you don't have the right to do that because they put every single word in place exactly as they intended it to be. And it's simply not, legally, it's absolutely not a choice you get to make. But I also think ethically there's a responsibility that you have to honor the playwright's work as it's written.
It is interesting to me that we seem to regard different types of intellectual property so differently. Like, why is it that we hold an inventor's patent in such high regard? Or I think your example of a novel was really astute as well. And yet, somehow, a playwright's script we treat as this thing that is up for slicing and dicing, or up for anyone to capitalize on. It irks me because I think it's part of this way that the arts, that theater gets derided, gets, I don't know, just written off as fluff. And, you know, we need to stand up for ourselves as an art form, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and also I feel like I should say that Erin is the publications associate of TCG Books, so she knows playwrights and she knows scripts.
Yeah. It's true. I also used to work in licensing, so I'm pretty familiar with the process and have actually in the past had to chase down people who made unauthorized cuts to shows.
And how often do those unauthorized cuts and people who make them, is there a fee for doing that? Kind of like David Mamet, you know, $25,000 if you hold a talk back kind of thing?
Yeah, it's something at the publishing house where I used to work, it's something we tended to take on a case-by-case basis, and it would also often be something we would bring to the author's attention, because, you know, as the licensing house, you are acting as an agent for the author, and so it is ultimately their decision, as it was in this case. But oftentimes, licensors like DPS or Samuel French, etc., will be on the lookout for any changes, or simply, you know, productions that aren't licensed at all, which also happens on a fairly regular basis. And usually what we would do is issue a warning, kind of like what happened here. And if people didn't comply, you know, then it would be decided on a case-by-case basis how we would proceed. But usually people would comply.
Right. I feel like it's one of those things that's so simple. Just ask permission. Why don't you just...
Yes.
Like, it's kind of like... changing the race of a character. Just ask permission. I remember a production of Sweeney Todd at East West Players, an Asian American theater in Los Angeles. And they wanted to make Joanna Asian, but the line is, you know, buried sweetly in your yellow hair. And they asked Sondheim if they can change it to raven hair, and he was completely fine with it. So I would think if they had asked if they could do that, or if he could work with them to adapt the work into something that is workable with a small theater budget, he would be inclined to do that, or most playwrights would.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of them would. And if they aren't, I mean, that again, that's within their right. But I do think the overall lesson here that many people know, but probably not enough people know, is just you need to ask for permission always, always, if you want to make any changes. And it's not a difficult thing to do. You just send in the request, hope for the best, and you might not get the answer you want, but you might.
Right. And that's even if you're a super tiny theater company like the Shelton. In my interview with Matt, he said the reason why he didn't ask for permission was essentially he was just intimidated by the playwright. Like, he thinks he's just this small fry, you know, tiny fish in a big pond. And he said he was, you know, too intimidated. So of course that's not an excuse at all. At all.
Right. Right.
Especially on the internet. Everyone is in contact with each other now. But what's been interesting is I've been seeing comparisons of this controversy to the Albee controversy in terms of, like, what can you do with a text and what is right and what is wrong in terms of how you change it, especially in conjunction with the rights holders. And so, I don't know. I mean, I know for me, I feel like casting is a little bit different because you're not changing the text or splicing it around for the most part. You're just changing the people who are playing it and then seeing like what their interpretations will bring to it because they are actors. And so is there a difference between this and Albie in casting?
I'm really glad you brought that up. One of my favorite thinkers out here in the Bay Area is Melissa Hillman, who's the artistic director of Impact Theater, and her blog is called Bitter Gertrude. And she wrote this whole thing on the Complete Works Project's attempt to cast a black actor as Nick in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And can I read a little bit of it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Just a few sentences here. It's worth reading in its entirety because it just lays out the argument so clearly. She writes, "Playwrights are currently allowed legal protections over their work, and we should as an industry be working to preserve that. The price for that is the occasional destructive, bigoted decision by a writer or a state. But that doesn't mean we should do nothing about these destructive, bigoted decisions. Quite the opposite. My point is, fight the bigotry head on, not the principle of the playwrights and intellectual property rights. Don't throw the baby out with the racist bathwater." So I really like the way she frames these essentially racist decisions by estates as a cost that we have to have for playwrights like Stephen Adlai Gyrgyz. His right to protect his work. There's probably not going to be a perfect copyright licensing system out there. Like, I don't know if we humans could construct something that would, I don't know, give us the righteous result in every single case. But, you know, If someone like Steven gets to, like, issue a cease and desist order when he feels like his artistic vision is being violated, I guess I feel like that good is worth the cost of a system that also allows Albie's estate to make its decisions.
Yeah, no, that was, I think, a really astute take on the Albie controversy, because like you've both noted, it is well within their legal protections to say who can and cannot be cast in certain roles. It is. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate, but it does mean that that's also going to protect the rights of the playwrights in other manners where it's, you know, a less controversial and racist thing to do. The other part that was from what you just read that was really important is that it doesn't mean that we can't put pressure on estates or playwrights and
absolutely
tell them what's what, tell them like why this is problematic and what they might want to reconsider. And because that's also well within our rights. And I think that's a really good way to look at that particular issue and think about how we can address anything similar in the future.
Yeah, we can criticize them and we can also decide to produce new works.
Yeah.
or works that fit within the parameter of what you need. I feel like if you're a small theater and you cannot do this big cast play.
There are so many small cast plays out there.
So many small cast plays.
Yeah.
There is one thing I wanted to add about it, because I remember the when the Lloyd's controversy was going down about a college that cast a white actor to play a role for a Middle Eastern American actor. I mean, a Middle Eastern character, and Lloyd's sent a cease and desist letter. And I believe Douglas Carter Bean of the Dramatists Guild issued a statement saying that, like, playwrights don't have a union, and they only get paid very small residuals. And so the control of the text of the work is basically all we have to give to playwrights in the American theater. And so them being able to say yes or no to any creative decisions is necessary. And also, and for me, adding on to what Douglas said, it's also it's also what makes it collaborative. You want the, if you want theater to be a collaborative art form with the playwright, then freaking just ask the playwright what they think about any changes you make. It really isn't a living document. You're just putting your own vision onto someone else's vision instead of having an actual dialogue about what's happening.
Yeah, or if you want to freely adapt something, take something that's not copyrighted anymore. You
that's
can do whatever you want with Shakespeare's plays, even if it doesn't make any sense. You can, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, or wait 70 years, and then you right. can do whatever you want to Goethe's play.
If you're still alive.
It will be so interesting to see all those Beckett productions that happen
oh, yeah.
once his body of work goes into the public domain, and I hope I live that long.
Oh, Lily, I hope we all live that long. I hope we're still alive next year, considering the rate we're going.
Yes, indeed.
Well said.
All right. Well, I believe that wraps up this discussion. We'll go to Rob's interview with Anishka Paris Carter and Andy Paris, and then we'll come back with recommendations for things.
So I'm here with Anushka Paris Carter and Andy Paris, who are the authors of Uncommon Sense. It's a new Tectonic Theater Project production about folks on the autism spectrum. And you've been working on this for a number of years. I know there was a TCG conference you came to about 3 years ago and spoke about it. And I've seen stories pop up over the years about it all over the place. So tell me about the beginnings of this project, your interest in it, and then we'll go through some of the process. It's been years in the making.
Well, it really first began because Tectonic had a grant, and they were looking for an idea to pursue. And they sent out, Greg Reiner, who was the executive director at the time, sent out an email saying, does anybody have anything that they're interested in pursuing? And Andy was sitting next to me in bed, and he said, honey, I really think I'm interested in doing a play about autism spectrum disorder. And I started to laugh. I remember it very clearly, thinking, oh, who would be interested in that other than the two of us? And we're interested in autism because we both have autism in our families, and sort of been an ongoing lifelong discussion for both of us. And so then, Andy, do you want to take it from there? What happened after that?
Yes. You know, I think it was really born of this idea that, you know, autism as a concept is relatively new in its construction. And we as a society are kind of grappling with what it means, what the definitions are of autism, how it expresses itself, why we're talking about it now, how it relates to sort of this brain-body connection as we learn more about the brain, and what, you know, how it's sort of manifests itself now in our culture. And it's something that's so difficult to explain. And it's, you know, ironic, I guess, or not ironic, that, you know, it's a lot of the core challenges of people on the spectrum are in sort of a kind of typical mode of communication, using words and formulating, you know, ideas through spoken language. And so, you know, at Tectonic, we had been studying for years, you know, what are the tools of the theater that make it, you know, inherently theatrical beyond just the text? What if we start with ideas? What if we start with imagery? What if we start with props and costume pieces? And where does that lead us in terms of the narrative? And so this seemed like just an ideal way to explore what's hiding behind the curtain of autism, and how we can really externalize an often mysterious internal experience.
Right. In other words, it sounds to me that you find theater is a way to talk about it that goes beyond just trying to explain it clinically, to like sort of embody it or strive to.
and strive to convey an experience, which really is what it is. It's a full, being on the spectrum is a full experience and something that you can express in a theater unlike any other medium. And so, but we really wanted to explore beyond our own personal experience, because what we know to be true is if you've met one person on the spectrum, you've met one person on the spectrum.
Yeah, right.
And so we just really started by talking to people. You know, we had already been kind of thrust into the autism community, but we were looking beyond our own experience and even beyond our own sort of circle of people that we knew. And we just started reaching out to anyone and everyone who would talk to us about their experience of being on the spectrum, and of knowing people on the spectrum or caring for people on the spectrum. And we just did mounds of talking to people and also just spending time, pool parties, doing activities that people on the spectrum like to do, you know, experiencing what we could of it.
Is there, I wanted to ask about that. Is there a formal sort of tectonic process about interviews? We have an issue about documentary theater in which different practitioners talk about the ways they do it, the ways they don't do it. And I'm wondering also, corollary to that, if there's a sort of formal interview where people are just telling you their experience, whether you have other ways of experiencing or if unexpected things happen while you're talking to them that illuminate something else that's theatrical. So it's not just testimony. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not really a documentary play at all. The interviews were done more as a really as background research. Right. It's the play is quite different to Laramie Project in that it's not a verbatim play at all. What we did was we looked for commonality in stories in terms of common themes, I would think. But then what happened was we sort of began to take the ball and run with it in terms of our imagination. And so we would put we would take elements of truth from people's stories, and then we would place them in imaginative situations and see how they would react. We made characters up, even though a lot of it's almost as if they're composite characters in a way. Each character is made up a little bit of we've taken stories from many different sources and then sort of compiled them in a way, as well as adding our own details. And I think when we were interviewing people, a lot of the time, we didn't really. One of the things that was surprising was, for me, was the level of intimacy that we had in terms of developing friendships with people on the spectrum. I mean, we sort of stopped running tape recorders after a while. A really good example is this one lady, Mary Robeson, who really we started interviewing her, and then we would really just after. Maybe at two or three meetings with her, we really just started to socialize with her, became very close with her. And I think that's true too. We have an actor on in the play, Andrew Duff, who is on the spectrum. His current girlfriend, Kirsten Lynn Smith, is someone that we interviewed before we even knew Andrew Duff.
Okay.
And there are text exchanges and email exchanges and telephone calls. And, you know, really there's a friendship there. But that was very surprising to me. And I think that's happened with a lot of people we've interviewed. We've become really close friends with them.
I think it is very, very different in the sense that I think it's been more important to spend a lot of time with people on the spectrum, not necessarily talking, doing things that they like to do or hanging out with them or going to events that they love to go to, experiencing their nature and kind of soaking up the kind of things they like or don't like, things that bother them, things they love, things that they're successful at, and just kind of, you know, recognizing them as full individuals, you know, and that, you know, looking almost beyond the autism to discover sort of whole people, whole characters, and so although the play is an investigation into the world of autism, what we hope is that we've captured, you know, the people and the love and the relationships that develop, you know, between people.
Right. I imagine it sounds like it sounds like there was an element of building trust as well. So that it's not just like you're there to strip mine their lives for details or just, oh, I'm observing them doing this. It's more like you got to know them as people, you know, obviously with this.
Yeah, I think it's being of the community too. Right. So it's not like we're, you know, kind of going in as investigative reporters. Right. We're, you know, reaching out to our friends and neighbors and people who we know and just, and trying to reflect from within.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the stage directions of the play a bit about how the stage directions are very important. It does seem a very tectonic thing to build the whole play, not just write the words, to build the whole play as a piece of theater. And of course, it's on the page there in the stage directions. I wonder, there's one stage direction I wanted to ask you about. There's a lot about light and sound that we're going to be hearing and water. But there's one, and I don't know if this is a bit of intentional synesthesia or if it's just a typo. It says, we hear the sound of light refracting, which I think was beautiful. It just popped out at me. I thought, you know, again, not to be too casual about it, but synesthetic sort of responses is part of, and maybe this is a way to ask about the theatricality, how you're going to theatricalize the sort of sense of what it's like to be on the spectrum.
Synesthesia is absolutely is intentional. That was intentional.
Okay,
It's been a real challenge to, you know, as you know, as the director approaching designers to do this play, you know, from a design standpoint, I've really asked them to kind of flip a little bit and kind of re-examine their discipline in relationship to all the others. And, you know, how their discipline might, you know, intersect or kind of almost replace another, how they can think of light as sound and think of sound as light and, what that means to them, you know, and how we can use all of the disciplines to, you know, to help to create this experience of being on the spectrum. And it's been a real challenge, and that was one of the reasons why it's taken so long to develop. It's several workshops of this play, practical workshops, getting everybody in the room together to just experiment. You know, how do you communicate this experience? And we're still working on it. Hopefully, this fall we will be able to take another step forward. But it's been an ongoing process. And I think the designers have really risen to the challenge. I think we have an incredible design team. And we're really excited to see this incarnation.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of video that might have been from Iowa. I don't know where it was taken, from another production of it. Cedars, I don't know. What's the name of it?
Cedar Falls,
Iowa. Yeah. And I don't know if you know the British company Filter Theater. The aesthetic was very much like tables, modular pieces, projections. I mean, they didn't invent that. It reminded me of that. And I also, of course, I'm sure you'll get the questions or comparisons to the one big, autism play, which is a Curious Incident. Yes. And the way in which that envisioned the world of that character and put that on stage. And I wondered if you looked at that example like that, and that's fine, but you're telling a different story or you want to do a different...
It was a stunning production, and I thought it was just gorgeous. And the main difference for me is that I think Curious Incident was a mystery play, and that autism was the obstacle in the way of the mystery being solved rather than a play about autism. Mm-hmm. And also something of a domestic drama, mm-hmm. whereas I think our piece is more an exploration of the human mind, how it works, the brain, how the brain works, similarities between the autistic brain and a neurotypical brain, differences between those two things, and how really the condition of being neurotypical and autistic can be quite similar at the
times.
And I think really the obstacles in our play are really, where does the neurotypical world bump up against the autistic world, and how do we get in each other's way, and how do we navigate those differences and challenges when our worlds bump up against each other?
I was just going to mention that we've had a lot of really interesting discussions with John Coyne, who's our set designer, who is a fantastic set designer and also happens to be, just someone else who's in the autism community. And we've talked a lot about how do you create an environment where anything is possible, but things feel at once like an opportunity and an obstacle kind of at the same time, where there's lots of possibility of discovery. But the world just doesn't seem quite solid under your feet, and mm-hmm. and where the sensory apparatus is really strong in some places, and then can sort of change, and so you can kind of go from something being really present to something being completely hidden,
right.
Where things feel like kind of pop out of nowhere, mm-hmm. So it's this very eclectic space, but one that's full of possibility.
For me, the set has always been rooted in story. The story being of one person that I've become very close to, that we interviewed very early on in Cedar Falls, actually. She described a night when she could not sleep, and this woman is a doctor that we interviewed, and her husband is a doctor as well, actually her ex-husband, and she'd been trying to convince her husband that there was something different about their son, and she was very nervous and anxious about it, and he was not having any of it. He refused to hear, refused to address her concerns. And so one night she got out of bed and she tiptoed down from the second story down to the first story of the house, and then she sort of made her way down into the basement and pulled out her old pediatric textbooks that she needed in medical school, and she opened her books and she saw that her son hit every single checklist meeting a criteria for autism, for an autism diagnosis. And she was down there in the basement all by herself, sort of flooded with this this knowledge of the difference of her child, the differences that her child presented. And then she had to make her way up out of the basement through the first floor and then through the maze of her house and back into bed with this knowledge. So she went down as one person and came back up as a different person. And I think that was such a similar trajectory that we found for a lot of people, not only on the spectrum, but off the spectrum. It's this moment of discovering the information and then making your way back up through the layers of the world. And so I always see that when I see the set, that there are stairs that go down, there are stairs that go up, there are platforms that lead you, like autism can, in one direction. You think you're going in one direction, and then actually you find out you're going in a different direction than you thought you were going in. And so it's very narrative to me, So it'll be interesting. I think the thing about the curious incident is I'm not sure what their premise was, but it was so clever. The way they did it was so clever, but I'm not sure if it was based on a personal narrative, the set. It seemed to me like they were able to recreate the railway station, mm-hmm. and they were able to, that great moment when, of course, the dog is on the floor with that iconic image with the pitchfork sticking out of him. I mean, so then we had sort of the front yard, and mm-hmm. it was so well done. The video design was just immaculate. Whereas our video designer, I think one of his challenges, he's illuminating the sensory experience a lot, right, of the characters, the interior sensory experience of the characters. So, you know, it's slightly different. There are some differences.
David and I have talked a lot about, you know, not falling into using projection to paint the set or set the scene.
Right.
And sort of talking about how it's really, really being strict with ourselves to not lean on projection so much, but rather to only use it to illuminate an experience that we wouldn't otherwise be able to garner. So, or to
David, what's his full name?
Bengali.
David Bengali.
Okay, great. Want to give credit there. What's fascinating, I think this was, whenever this material comes up, whether it's in a play or an article, or it seems to raise, this is Oliver Sacks territory, raises cognitive questions about all that we all face, about, you know, the lines that pop out for me a lot in this piece are, he doesn't know what he knows. But then we find out we really don't know what we know. We don't know what's locked in our brains. Our brains don't always know what we're, you know, what we're doing. So again, it explores sort of universal questions about sort of cognition. I mean, I guess that's obviously something that you two, as folks who are not on the autism spectrum, designing a show which the audiences will be, you know, a mix of people. But there's access points for all of us to find ourselves in this piece, right?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly want to, you know, reflect the experience of autism, but we also want to be inclusive and kind of let people in on the experience who might otherwise not know the experience of autism. So we're walking a duality a little bit, and which is a challenge, you know, because sometimes we veer too far in one direction, and people who aren't on the spectrum or aren't familiar with the spectrum, they come to the workshop and go, I didn't quite understand that one part, and so we're sort of playing with how much we have to explain and how much actually is you know, answerable in the mystery and how we present it. So
yeah, I wonder about that. About you say it's definitely not a verbatim play, but it's based on research and it has a sort of explanatory educational aspect to it. But I wonder, at some point, you're making a piece of theater, and having read the script, I know that it's not just a lesson plan. But I wonder about walking that line between you're informing people and then you're also giving them something unexpected and entertaining.
Yeah, and that's the first and foremost. We're trying to make something that will engage audiences in these big questions about who we are and about difference in our culture and how we handle that and what it means to respect someone else's experience. Mm-hmm. And how relationships develop across different, you know, chasms that we all have to cross in order to reach someone else. And that's really what the play is about. And it uses autism as, you know, autism is a main filter. But it really comes down to how do we want to live together in this community?
Last thing I wanted to ask you about was one thing. We've written a bit about how theater is being used to help autistic folks on the spectrum, you know, just help them learn collaboration, communication. We had a recent piece that was very popular about studies with Shakespeare, how Shakespeare's with children on the autism spectrum has just been an amazing, not just the words, but the characters and the situations. So it seems like one thing that struck me when I was reading the Dan is the character in your play who has Asperger's syndrome, and he tends to talk a lot. And one thing that struck me is it comes up a lot when we're writing about this, that some folks on the spectrum use scripts to sort of get through their day. They don't know what to say, so they have things that they rehearse and say. And that struck me as very theatrical. And also struck me as maybe a mixed blessing that you have a character who just likes to talk a lot and explain things a lot. So you can do a lot of exposition with a character on the spectrum, but then you also have to rein it in. There's other characters who are less articulate.
Yeah, well, I think that's also That's also the danger is Dan speaks, Dan as a character speaks for himself, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
He doesn't really speak for autism. So,
right, that's true.
So yeah, that is the danger, because if you let him go on and on, he leads astray from all the other characters.
Right, right.
It's true that scripting is inherently theatrical. It's, mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why people on the spectrum do connect well to Shakespeare is because Shakespearean characters are large and they do have a lot to say.
Yeah.
And you know, back in the day when you could do a 4-hour play and not a play that was an hour and a half long, you could afford to script a lot more language. But you know, and Dan is one of those characters that we have edited down to just, you know, there's so much about Dan that we would love to have in, but there's just not enough time. But and he does use scripting to get through and puns and mm-hmm. that's another reason why I think Shakespeare is so appealing. Puns and alliteration is so delightful for many people on the spectrum. It's so accessible because of those things. I wish we could have Dan go on forever, but we have an hour and a half.
Is he based on any one particular person, or is he a composite as well?
He's based on a young man named Dan Waterbury in Iowa.
Okay.
And there are a few things. I mean, certainly he has a wife named Sarah.
Okay.
He does have a degree in veterinary science, and he is an actuary scientist.
Okay.
I don't believe he smeared noodles over his wife's face on the first dish.
Or licked her feet or something. Right, right, right.
No, but I will say that somebody else did lick somebody else's toes. That did happen somewhere else, but I just stole that blatantly.
Spoiler for the audience there, right?
Yeah. And the noodle thing, that was just...
been very gracious about allowing us to include many things in his experience.
Right.
So that's what we mean. You know, it's like some of it's very closely based on Dan, and then we also brought in a lot of other characteristics from other people and he's on good with that.
Right, and you've got character of Lolly who's learning to make sound and communicate, but then she discovers text as a way to do it. There's all different examples. As you say, the spectrum hardly begins to describe how wide a range of experiences and abilities it encompasses. Yes, Anushka?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why we sort of make composites, because we really only have, the four... Well, there are more than four characters in the play that are on the spectrum, but the four sort of leading characters.
Mm-hmm.
We had to try and jam as many experiences of the spectrum into those four people. So that's why they're so composited like that. Because otherwise, I don't think we would... I mean, as it is, there's so much that's missing. There's just... I mean, people will come and some people will say, but what about this? You didn't do this.
Yeah.
And what about this? You didn't do that.
I continued to lobby to Tectonic for 15, a cast of 15 or 20, but they keep whittling. But, you know, I mean, really, ultimately, in order to really create, you know, the tapestry that is the autism community, that's what you would need.
Right,
you know,
right.
it's really that varied. So we're doing the best with what we have as theater people do.
Yeah.
That's great. It opens October 25th at the Sheen Center in downtown New York, and I can't wait to see it. Thanks for talking to me, too.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right.
Take care.
All right. Bye now.
And we're back. I hope you enjoy that interview. And now we have things for you to read or see or look at. Erin, do you want to start?
Sure. So mine is theater adjacent because it was created by a playwright and actress, but available for all to watch on Amazon Prime. It's not a brand new show, but I'm still kind of trying to get everyone I know to watch this because I think it's been underappreciated. It's called Fleabag by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And it's adapted from a one-woman show that she wrote. And it follows, she's the star of the show as well. It follows a young woman who has recently lost her best friend, living in London, and trying to figure out life. That description doesn't really do it justice. It's hilarious and brash, and not safe for work, but it's wonderful. And just to put in a little plug, it's published by TCG's partner publisher, Nick Hearn Books in the UK, and you can purchase it through TCG Books here in the US.
Well, boy, howdy.
Yes, I we love shouting things that are related to us and theater. How long is it multi-season, one season?
So far, and I don't know if they're going to make any more. It's one season, but it's kind of like that UK season. It's like 6 half-hour installments, so you can watch it all pretty quickly. You could just do a binge in one night, really.
Right, well, shorter than an elevator repair service show. That's great.
Exactly.
Lily, what do you have?
Well, one of the best shows I've seen this summer is at California Shakespeare Theater in the Oakland Hills, and it's called Black Odyssey. It's written by an Oakland native named Marcus Gardley and directed by our still new artistic director at Cal Shakes, Eric Ting. And so this is, as the title suggests, a Black reimagining of the Homeric epic. And first of all, and I got this just reading the script before I saw the show, it's a too rare treat just to get to see Black characters as gods and goddesses in regal costumes, deciding the fate of mortals over a capricious game of chess, mm-hmm. speaking lofty, poetic language that's, well, lofty, but also earthy, very earthy. Gardley just has this constant dizzying wordplay where things are rhyming and punning on each other. And one of my favorite scenes, and I took my Midwestern Texas parents to see this show. So this should give you a sense of just how wide the appeal is if both their crazy San Francisco daughter and they can like it. The show envisioned the sirens as like some of the 20th century's pantheon of Black artists, like Diana Ross, Tina Turner, and James Brown. And so that their music could be so gorgeous that you can't even stand to listen to it. It was brilliant and hilarious. If I may read a small portion of my review also, I also loved the whole overall project because it like reappropriates a foundational text of the Western canon, which is a literature that's often been used to justify the elevation of one civilization and the enslavement of others as a means for its protagonist to tap into his own and his race's history to build consciousness and identity and worth. It was a brilliant and sly and bold reappropriation. I just loved it. I was so happy. So happy.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just spoke to Eric because I'm doing a piece about his first season at Cal Shakes. And I think it's part of something he's starting called, what is it, the Living Classics Initiative? I haven't looked at my notes yet, but he's trying to have living writers adapt classic works. So at least every season there will be a living writer on the roster, so it's not all dead.
Kind of reminds me of what's going on at OSF. That's way cool.
Yes.
Way cool.
Oh.
All right.
I'm like, great things going on in the Bay Area or the Northwest. So anyhow, so what I'm recommending is this Tumblr. It's called Cast and Loose, and spelled out. And what it is, it's It's both a depressing and hilarious compendium of offensive casting notices.
Oh my God.
Yay.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, yay.
And, you know, I can't describe it. I'm just going to read some to you because, you know, these certain things just, there are no words. So, Maggie, 20 to 40 year old, all ethnicities female, sexy, and in charge of her feminine wiles, a quote-unquote actress. Very talented, very underappreciated. Life is not fair, the diva of regional theater. Ugh. Or this one, Diana / supporting role, 20 to 28. She is a bright girl with a beautiful personality, even though she is a blind girl.
No.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
No.
Even though.
No. Why? No.
How could that be possible?
Oh, God. We're doomed, you guys. We're doomed.
Yeah, that just puts like a cherry on top of this episode. Anyway. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
And you can find links to the things that we talked about in this episode at americantheater.org. Just look for the off-script tag. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Please rate and review us. Unless you don't like us, then don't say a word. All right, we'll see you next time.